Datanauts power through the infrastructure galaxy, we come across Planet Intel and set our engineering rocket down on their cradling sponsored landing pad. That's right, Intel has sponsored the Datanauts today for a discussion we're recording from San Francisco at the 2016 Intel Developers Forum. I am Ethan Banks, your host. You can follow me at EC Banks, and with me is special guest host, many of you know, Greg Farrow at Ethereal Mind, and this is the Datanauts podcast. You can find this and all our shows on iTunes and your favorite podcatcher or at packetpushers.net. Software-defined infrastructure is our topic of discussion for this show, and joining me from Intel is Matthew Brender, developer advocate on the software-defined infrastructure team at Intel, and Rajesh Gardiar, Senior Director for Architecture and Systems Engineering in the Network Platforms Group at Intel. That was a mouthful to get from LinkedIn. Starting with Matt. Matt, welcome to the show. Please introduce yourself to the engineering folks that are listening to you now.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me back, guys. I'm Matthew Brender. I'm a developer advocate at Intel. I get to focus on orchestration engineering. So we touch telemetry as it feeds into analytics and orchestration engines to basically make the data center smarter and increase utilization.
Yeah. Okay. And Rajesh.
Yes. My name is Rajesh Gardiar. I'm a director of architecture and I lead architecture and systems engineering efforts in Network Platforms Group at Intel. And my team is really focused on building a scalable and efficient architecture and deliver platforms for next generation network infrastructure.
Very good. So the topic of today, software-defined infrastructure, and I think we need to level set for the audience here because software-defined anything automatically rings of architecture and just bullcrap. So let's get real here. From Intel's perspective, what is SDI?
For our team, we're building tools to make it so that you can get all the value out of each individual layer of hardware and software that you use in the data center, but treat it as an aggregate pool. Which sounds very fancy, but what it comes down to is if you're running some sort of platform or you're deploying something like Kubernetes on top of an infrastructure of servers, those servers aren't all homogeneous and the operating systems on top of those are not all identical. And then you have Kubernetes, then you have Docker containers on top of that, and then you have the apps on top of that. Ideally, you'd be able to orchestrate across those layers and not have to care about the nuances of each individual server as the old pets versus cattle conversation. The software-defined portion is being able to intelligently see into those different layers of the infrastructure, automate effectively, and be able to reproduce that in a meaningful way as you scale up to the infinity of cloud.
Scale up to the infinity of cloud. That belongs on a t-shirt. Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So here's another question. For people that are coming from a traditional infrastructure background, why do I want to move to software-defined infrastructure? Or do I? I mean, are there specific problems that SDI is solving?
First of all, the group that I come from Intel's Network Platforms Group, and we're actually focused on the telco infrastructure. So this is everything that sits from between the devices and the cloud. It's the part that all the voice and data and video traffic and machine-to-machine traffic actually takes as it traverses from the client endpoints all the way into the cloud and back. Today, if you look at actually what that infrastructure looks like, it's largely appliances that are custom-built, fixed function, that do certain things really well. But that flexibility and scalability and the ability to really provide the benefits of standard IT in that network infrastructure is completely missing.
Because if you've got an appliance that does the one thing, you've got to route traffic through the appliance that does the one thing. You have to treat it uniquely and special, and it becomes a finite resource. You can't scale it especially well. And so you're talking about more making the infrastructure generic to a point that you can make it do whatever you need.
Right. So two things. One is actually to really open up the platform, network platform. So instead of actually appliance solutions that do one-on-one thing only, and the need for deploying a firewall as an appliance, a load balancer, an intrusion prevention system, versus really converting an Intel server into a networking box. So virtualizing some of these network functions and really helping get a better TCO, but also actually delivering the cloud scale to the network functions and network deployment. That's what software-defined infrastructure is from a network view or network standpoint.
Now, you mentioned telcos as being keen on this. What about enterprises?
From my perspective, actually, enterprises are showing a lot more agility and velocity because I think the decision-making typically in the telco infrastructure actually takes a longer time as compared to enterprises have the ability to actually make some of those decisions to drive the virtual appliance deployments and so on actually at a much rapid pace. And so we are actually seeing a lot more momentum right now, even in the enterprise space. So it's not just a telco thing for us.
Telco may have the most immediate need and are already operating at scale where they can take the best advantage of this, but enterprises are seeing it too.
That's right. And you know, in many ways, actually, I've seen actually in industry, people equate network function virtualization and SDN as like a telco thing. But in reality, actually, NFV is happening in enterprises. It's happening in private and public cloud. And we are seeing actually NFV in telco.
I think one of the things that we miss in the discussion around NFV in the enterprise is that there's so many people saying we need to do CapEx avoidance. We should move to the cloud so we don't spend CapEx. But there's many ways to avoid CapEx, and NFV is one of them. Building a virtual appliance means you don't have to buy a custom piece of hardware, run it as a VM. And without that, you then don't have to go and buy a piece of what is fundamentally an x86. Like you look at any modern load balancer or proxy server IDS, it's an x86 computer with a fancy NIC most times, right? If you can avoid buying that, then all of a sudden you've avoided an enormous amount of CapEx. You still pay software licensing fees, and hopefully the vendors will start to moderate their expectations, and instead of trying to charge you hardware plus software prices for just the software, which is an issue, right? And that will change over time as the market pressures them into place. You can do CapEx avoidance and achieve cloud, that is OPEX, just by shifting to virtual appliances or NFV.
And actually, in many ways, I also think as NFV as driving the next innovation cycle, because it's really opened up the platform. It's actually opened up the playing field for the next set of developers to come in and contribute to the evolution of the network, especially as we go towards 5G. That's actually going to change the whole paradigm. There's so much video content already on the in the network, which is driving a lot of IP packet traffic. But with the advent of 5G, it's actually going to be so much about machine-to-machine and IoT, and all that is actually going to drive so much more requirement around special classes of service assurance, security, better packet processing.
Yeah, I think there's multiple use cases for NFV. There is the service provider and the enterprise use case. But the service provider one is really quite unique. And one of them that I saw, because we're at the Intel IDF conference, and the one I saw today is this virtual radio access network, where in the 5G, we're early in the standard cycle. But the carriers are saying, we need this now. We need to be putting proof of concepts. We need to be doing, and the first generation of products, we can't wait for ASICs. So we need to be able to deploy these things as VMs for the management software. You know, the what's going to manage the radio head, what's going to manage the counting and the radius and the diameter and, you know, all those sorts of things that are in there. And interestingly, the other part is that they're talking about using FPGAs instead of ASICs for the first run so that you can keep rewriting the code where they need the custom parts. At the radio head end where you're driving the antennas and doing MIMO at scale, they're going to be using what is fundamentally a software program, a chip for the time being. I do think we'd forget that software also means that appliances can be iterated very rapidly. We see a change, we can change it. Whereas if you've got hardware, going out and rotating your hardware because there's something is a 10-year effort, you know, or in carrier's case is 20 years. There's much more to it than just cost avoidance.
But achieving that means you're abstracting away that hardware and not really dealing with it directly so much, which, Matt, goes back to something you had said when we were trying to define what SDI is. You had mentioned a pool of resources and that you can have a whole lot of hardware that maybe aren't all equivalent to one another that are part of this pool. What does that really mean? Can you give us some more detail on that pool idea?
I think Greg started to dig into it perfectly. If you think about this from an individual engineer's point of view, you just want to be able to rapidly create on top of your available resources. So resources, x86 hardware. Create means I need to store information. I need something that will process the packets moving around.
But not caring one what particular server.
I don't care what particular server it is. That said, I also don't want the lowest common denominator server. I don't want that every time I update part of my cloud infrastructure, I get the least amount of features across all those pieces of hardware. So there's something about seeing a pool of available compute that I can allocate to different needs in my data center for different reasons. But there's also something about if I have particular needs, I can see those at the right layer of abstraction so that I don't lose out on key features that differentiate the latest hardware from, you know, last gen.
So there's some interesting things there. I was down on the show floor talking to the person. They've got OpenStack QoS, mm-hmm. which is literally what they're doing is mapping the last tier of cache. So most CPUs, it's layer 3. Some of them, it's layer 2, the L2, L3 caches, and allocating those caches so that you don't have the noisy neighbor VM problem. Now, if you're a network engineer, you've been doing quality of service for decades, And you're looking at this going like, duh. welcome to 2016, server guys. And
actually, that's very interesting because that technology, the resource director technology, internally we refer to it as cache QoS, actually came from my organization in Network Platforms Group.
Probably 20 years ago.
And we actually want to take that even further. So we want to actually get to a point where it's not just about cache, but we can apply the same semantics to memory quality of service and really actually embed quality of service in every single subsystem on the platform.
Yeah, I just got confused when I saw OpenStack QoS and it was trying to tell me that server QoS. And of course, as a networking guy, I'm going like QoS is QoS. You have to find another word.
So this set of capabilities that we have enabled, actually, you know, Matt made a really good point earlier, right? Because although, you know, when you look at disaggregated architecture where you have pools of compute, pools of storage, pools of memory, pools of accelerators, you want to actually apply your best resources to solving a particular workload and a particular problem. You made a reference to SD-RAN earlier, right? Or software-defined RAN or Cloud RAN as it's called. Now, certain parts of that would probably still want to actually innovate with an FPGA or an accelerator on the platform. And making sure that whatever assets are available on the platform is exposed to OpenStack and to the application in that manner, so you can instantiate the workloads where you are going to get the best-in-class performance per watt per dollar. So that is actually our vision. It's not so much about abstracting the hardware. We want to actually do that to some extent. But it's really actually, there's all these innovations that are happening in hardware, right? You mentioned quality of service. There's all different kinds of accelerators that are coming on IA platforms. We want to make sure that all of that goodness is exposed to orchestrators. So when you're placing the workload, you know the full capability of the platform.
This is the key to software-defined hardware, is that Intel has all of these hardware capabilities that are in the CPU. You've been exposing them progressively since over the last 2 years. Like, this ability to slice and dice the L3, L2 cache is a new feature. And you go around and you look at, and I've just come from a session on Snap telemetry about how they're exposing counter data that's actually inside the CPUs and making it really easy to consume. And effectively, what you're now able to do is to software define the CPU. Now, there's limits here. There's not unlimited awesomeness here. A hardware is a hardware and it doesn't. It's not like you can just upload a new build of CPU and lo and behold, it organically.
You can't throw a JSON object at a CPU and tell it like, okay, now we do this with our caching.
Could you lodge a PR for that? You really need to get that.
There is something about visibility that's exceptional here that I think if I've learned anything from being part of the Snap project and open sourcing that, it's that visibility into low-level hardware metrics alongside application statistics and other sort of telemetry is exceptionally empowering in ways you can't predict until you start visualizing it. So there's something about gathering things at the levels that you didn't even know you could, whether that's smarts data off disks or LLC occupancy to see how your layer 3, layer 2, and layer 1 caches are going on your CPU and start seeing, is the thing that I think is multi-threaded, is it actually doing a good job of using my CPUs effectively? You can start really optimizing applications in ways you couldn't if you never began to measure them.
And actually, just to add a little bit more color to what Matt said, because it's really important, that paradigm extends to something called service assurance, because what happens in the NFV world, as you virtualize the network functions, the challenge that service providers are facing is twofold. One, they're saying, hey, you know, with appliances, I knew exactly what performance I was going to get if I deployed, let's say, a 10-gig router, right? Because you put that in the network, you get 10-gig performance. Now, when I actually deploy a virtual network function on a standard server platform, how do I actually plan my capacity? And then the second order problem is, now if I onboard these VNFs or the virtual network functions, how do I guarantee a level of an SLA and a quality of service? And so the telemetry that Matt was talking about and the ability to have a good tight control over the resource utilization and as a result of that, be able to move the VNFs around and get the best-in-class TCO, I think is very fundamental to software-defined infrastructure and how the network and the infrastructure would be deployed in future.
Does SDI imply cloud? I mean, does it mean we're operating in a cloudy way? That's always the context we're talking in, and I don't know that there's another alternative.
You know what? I wonder if that's just an opinion statement. I don't think I can speak from authority on there, but I think when it comes to cloud and it comes to SDI, yeah, we're looking at the same things. We're looking at a sense of elasticity, self-healing principles, and these are things that if I was playing with a Venn diagram, they're going to fall in the middle of cloud and SDI. There might be edge cases where you're going down different directions.
Okay, so stats recently will tell us that a lot of shops are heading towards hybrid cloud deployments. We're talking about the enterprise. We're talking about probably hybrid cloud in some way. How does that affect SDI? I mean, public cloud is some other set of resources up there as opposed to private cloud, my hardware that I'm consuming here.
You know what? I've been playing with a tool from CoreOS recently called Tectonic, and that is an interface by which you can manage your hybrid cloud behind a single interface and be able to actually spin up resources and from dev environment in public cloud to on-premises when you are going into production. Without even needing to change the source code, it's handling all the mappings of the different API calls to handle that for you. That feels very software-defined to me, and it's very cloudy, and I don't have to care about how that works, which is the best of all three worlds. So I think we're getting to a place where we're going to care less. We're going to do a lot of things for business reasons. We're going to do things for total cost of the TCO of it. But as an operations engineer, and I like to think from like button seat, like who's the one with the on the command line figuring this stuff out, we're going to want to care less about where it's going.
I always want to challenge the care less, right? Because hardware always matters. What we are seeing is a rebalancing. For many, many years, the infrastructure was complicated. There wasn't enough CPU cycles. There wasn't enough memory gigabytes. There wasn't enough gigabits in the network. And we've sort of reached a point recently where our vendors have kind of given us what we asked for. More CPU, more memory.
You know, actually, to me, the key value vectors really are programmability, automation, and scalability. It's really delivering those three key value vectors with a cloud scale.
And what we aren't actually talking about in those three things is, I don't have enough CPU, I don't have enough network, I don't have enough storage, right? That's the first thing. So it's a rebalancing. For the last 20 years, in a way, what we've had is not enough of anything. So the infrastructure people had to control access, and that led to deprecation or devaluing of the development cycle. And what we've got now is this rebalancing. I'm waving my hands in the air, but a rebalancing of...
It's a great visual,
the
everyone.
Infrastructure can pull back. Right, and there's no longer a bottleneck there, which allows the developers to start to get access to the resources that they want with less gatekeeping because there's enough of it to share.
Because there's abundance of it. It's a really great point to add to it, because if we didn't have an abundance of available hardware that we're poorly utilizing overall, we wouldn't be going down this path that we are.
We can't software define unless there's an abundance, right? You've got to have cycles to burn in software to manage the hardware.
Yet at the same time, Greg, if we do a good job at using software-defined infrastructure as a principle, we'll be able to better utilize what we are consuming by using resources in more of a just-in-time manner. Like, I need more network power now, therefore I provision more networking.
20 years ago, when servers were $10,000 a piece, or $20,000 a piece, you couldn't allocate a machine to be a software controller.
That's fair.
Or a deployment platform or a software-defined infrastructure. There's some fundamental market shifts which are driving this rebalancing. I'm delighted to see DevOps come up and, you know, the rise of the developer, but it's the rise of the developer coming up now that we've solved the infrastructure problem.
So with that rise, does that rise become universal? In other words, is software-defined infrastructure going to be the way that all of IT is practiced eventually? Any opinion?
Yes. Next question.
No, but I do agree. Actually, I think... I will recognize, though, that this is not a switch that you turn on and off and suddenly everything sort of like moves to a software-defined paradigm.
You start with a pod. You start with an application that needs the platform.
Certain applications, certain parts of the network, if I take the network example, are going to lend itself better. But over time, I think what's really happening is the data center cloud and the network cloud are coming together, and there's going to be a homogeneity in terms of how I mentioned earlier about server becoming a networking box. And so as that becomes homogeneous, I think, you know, you're sort of like, you can envision over time that we're getting to that more and more of a software-defined homogeneous infrastructure.
To follow up my jest with some serious thought, it comes down to we will do things that are better for the person that sits at their desk and has to get work done in the infrastructure. And being software-defined is to give them permission to fix things in a way and be able to reprovision and not just be based on these very strict requirements for the hardware and the software and the application, but to think more dynamically about what resources are available and do what's best for the company. And that makes people happy when they can fix the problems that they see. So I think we will absolutely get more software-defined. DevOps as a cultural element will feed more into enterprise because it makes people happier, and I think IT people need to be happy at the end of the day, and we've done a really bad job of that for the last number of years.
Mm-hmm. one of the things that I think, Ethan, is that software-defined infrastructure is happening because we have enough hardware, right? For the first time in sort of like ever, we've got enough hardware memory disks to be able to do this. So you can afford to start investing money in analytics and telemetry platforms. Whereas in the past, we were just happy if it got it to work and then we stumbled onto the next project in a fugue of exhaustion and relief. And I think that software-defined infrastructure, the first recognition or the first part of the five-step cycle is acceptance that this is where it's heading. And you've got to work out that you need to start extending yourself to do this.
So I thought that I took away was the realization that not all hardware resources match. When you're dealing with your data center and you're going to abstract it away with some sort of software-defined paradigm, you're dealing with systems that don't have all the same memory, don't have all the same CPU, don't have all the same storage, whatever that may be. But they still all have to be part of a pool so that you can consume them in that abstracted way. And you need a scheduler that can cope with that, not to kind of hit me between the eyes, because every time I've ever built any infrastructure, it's always matchy-matchy. Everything's got to be identical.
And think about what you do today. You buy these massive servers with the predicted memory for the next 10 years. You know, you buy the Uber server.
You max it out.
You max it out because you can't afford to take it down. And,
right, exactly.
So this is a step in that direction.
So Matt, we've been throwing around the word marketecture, kind of joking about that. Ha ha, it works good on a whiteboard. But there is, in fact, reality to software-defined infrastructure. And there's folks that are working on that IT stack, a software-defined IT stack, and running it in production. Well, let's talk about the IT stack. I mean, typically you got a controller that's got some applications on it that are pushing infrastructure changes for us. There is that software itself, whatever it would be. We've got some abstraction layers in there that are kind of doing some magic for us, as I give air quotes. There's typically APIs involved, right? We've got, as you'd mentioned, NFV, or there's VNFs that are a part of this equation to deploy this infrastructure, et cetera. And there's actually real hardware down there somewhere, right?
Absolutely, yeah. If you kind of start from the base up, you have servers, whether you have them on your own site or floating around in a cloud. You've got the servers, and then on top of that, you're usually talking through some sort of operating system.
Some sort of operating system, typically being Linux, of some flavor. You know, you mentioned CoreOS earlier.
Absolutely.
It could be that, but it's some platform that can be controlled either, you know, inherently or with whatever packaging is on top of it, maybe Docker.
Yeah, and I come from a VMware background, so if I'm talking to any VXpert type people out there, like, we would take our hardware, we'd throw ESXi on top of that, and then we start putting operating systems in there in the VMs, and then there are applications on top of that.
Sure.
I think the stack is getting a little flipped, where people are saying, let's run bare metal with a lightweight operating system as light as possible, and then run our orchestration at that layer. So we're talking about Kubernetes or Mesos.
Yeah, it's not a foregone conclusion that there's a hypervisor sitting there anymore.
No matter what, there's some sort of layer that's doing your orchestration across nodes and has some sort of intelligence scheduling element to it, without a doubt. I think the rise of containers has given us an opportunity to change that abstraction and allow us to recognize that some schedulers can be more intelligent at placing workloads than we are as the all-knowing operations engineer. And maybe that's a healthy place for us to get out of.
You mentioned scheduling. What the heck are we talking about? Let's pretend, if I haven't heard of scheduling before, how would you describe it to me?
Okay, let's say you are the master node in our little cluster here, Ethan, and I'm a worker node, Rajesh and Greg are worker nodes. Somebody passes something to one of us and we say, hey, where should this go? And you say, okay, well, it needs these types of resources, memory, compute, disk, and maybe a certain number of things. There could be particular workload profiles that just run on particular pieces of hardware. You look and see if there's availability in whatever you call your pool, which is the four of us as people. And you say, Greg, you're taking this one. This is your project now. You just acted as a scheduler. So it's some sort of intelligence in a clustered environment that understands what resources are available to it and can then make the decision of whether to commit to running the work that it's been asked to or to say, actually, sorry, you're queued up behind this other job.
Okay, now you mentioned storage and compute, but network is also another important pool that's there, right? Rajesh, with VNFs, how does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, great question, actually. If I take the HC standards view of NFV, there are essentially three components, and that makes it actually easy to look at this in a structured fashion, right? So we have the NFV infrastructure, which is obviously the hardware platform, OS, and hypervisors, but also there is a ton of software investment that is going into, from an Intel perspective, into those software components that are closer to hardware that allows you to get the best out of the hardware platform and make the APIs and the capabilities available to the applications, which are the VNFs, which is the second part, right?
So in other words, we have an issue here in the sense that we're used to deploying network functions on a dedicated appliance that probably has ASICs that are dedicated to the purpose of accelerating and getting line rate performance, whether that's a switch or that could be a firewall or a load balancer. Some of those might be x86, some of them not. A lot of them have accelerator chips in them for things like acceleration. You take all that functionality, you try to move it into a generic x86 platform. Now we have a performance challenge. Okay, so getting the performance out of that box is...
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So what we're trying to do is trying to take the magic out of doing those optimizations, which every OEM or every developer had to go through and look at actually how do I optimize my packet processing. And like you said, there are many different architectures and so on. So what we did is, you're probably familiar with DPDK, the Data Plane Development Kit.
Yes, very
much. Which is... Yeah. A set of optimized libraries and a set of drivers that has really changed the paradigm of packet processing on general purpose or standard, you know, server platforms, because it has taken the performance from what used to be less than 1 million packets per second to today it's over 300 million packets per second. So it's
uses SRVIO.
No, this is 300 million packets per second that I was referring to is bringing packets in and forwarding by doing a 5-tuple or a 7-tuple classification, right, and sending the packet out. But aside from that, so that's just packet forwarding. But we've actually done a lot of other key functions that we believe is fundamental to the NFVI or NFV infrastructure. So things like deep packet inspection. So we have an open source software library called Hyperscan that does line rate pattern matching and regular expression processing. Now, this used to be done in special purpose accelerators or ASICs before. The virtual switching. When you talk about NFV, there's a paradigm called service function chaining, which is actually chaining together the virtual functions. As a result of chaining together of these virtual functions, there is a lot of traffic now that's going east-west versus the traditional north-south. And so that's another thing that we have looked at, and we are actively working to improve the virtual switching performance on the IA platforms, right? There's other things like quick assist where we recognize that for performance per watt per dollar, so things like cryptography, SSL, TLS transactions, compression, data compression. Those are the kind of things that we have implemented as accelerators on the platform. And we actually try to take the magic out of optimizing for these accelerators by providing the necessary drivers and a set of libraries that actually provide somewhat transparent interface in terms of how the applications can make use of all these capabilities on an IA platform.
As an engineer, an infrastructure engineer who wants to get that performance out of DPDK and the various libraries that are there, what magic do I have to do? Is it simply available to me as a function of Linux, or is there something I have to install to get there?
Actually, that's a great question. So first of all, DPDK is a very vibrant community. We just had a DPDK summit last week, and we had 300 or so developers from academia, different companies, participate. So it's an open source community. It's actually seeing participation from not just Intel, but other companies. You know, today DPDK is integrated into many applications, and it's actually, you know, providing a really good performance.
In other words, integrated is the key word there. So if I install an application that's got DPDK integrated, I don't have to do any other magic.
That, and also actually, if you take a standard distribution like Red Hat, now Red Hat actually has DPDK as a package that is available as a part of standard Red Hat distribution. I believe the same thing is true for Ubuntu as well.
Now, this will work across any x86 hardware, and what about NICs? Are there particular NICs I need to have?
DPDK today actually supports a number of NICs, not just Intel NICs, like our 10 gig and 40 gig NICs, but there is actually support for Mellanox and other NICs as well. And it's the same thing from an architecture perspective. So DPDK today supports IA, obviously, and there's a lot of good performance on Intel architecture platforms. But it also supports Power architecture. It also supports ARM today, actually. So Cavium has recently uploaded patches, and they support DPDK as well. So it's really becoming an API of choice for high-performance packet processing on standard server platforms.
Okay, so we've tied a lot of the pieces and parts that are a part of a software-defined infrastructure. Let's talk about some of the software that would be added to that in addition to DPDK. A lot of the reference architectures that I've seen, OpenStack, OpenDaylight, are two big important pieces. Is that a pretty typical from what you guys are seeing as far as deployments?
Yeah, and actually this is where I was beginning to talk about the etsy reference architecture. So I talked about two things. I talked about NFV infrastructure and the VNFs. But the third piece of this is really the MANO, or the management and orchestration. And so this is where you have SDN controllers like OpenDaylight, and you have OpenStack with this capability called Enhanced Platform Awareness. And what that really means is all this goodness that I talked about, DPDK, you know, we talked earlier about the resource director technology and CacheQS and stuff like that, making that visible to OpenStack and be able to use that for instantiating the applications and getting the best performance. So we are actually doing a lot of work in OpenStack and also in OpenDaylight as the SDN controller. So that actually is also important from the perspective of service assurance and delivering to the SLA and quality of service for different kinds of end-to-end solution deployments as well.
Okay, so if I'm an infrastructure engineer and I've heard terrible things about OpenStack, because I am and I have, how do I deal with that, the intimidation factor of trying to get OpenStack up and running?
I think it's a lot to do with trust and follow the paths that have been set in front of you. If you are going and installing each part of OpenStack yourself and managing the RabbitMQ instances and the SQL instances and each of the little front ends and scripts that you have to do to get it running on your own, I think you're a certain type of self-destructor that doesn't need to be running in the way you're doing. There are very cool tools out there. I think one that I've enjoyed playing with lately is called Stackinetes, which we were talking about before the show a little bit. And that's a bit of a proof of concept that's being hardened into a project that could be used where you're running Kubernetes as a control plane for then OpenStack on top of it.
Yeah, the idea is Kubernetes is going to keep all your OpenStack components up and running.
Well, it also has to do with something about availability of them. So a common challenge of OpenStack is that the authentication service Keystone is rather chatty. And once you start having people log in at certain times during the day, you can have people locked out for a little bit as you're dealing with that chatter back and forth. So what's nice about running it on Kubernetes is that Kubernetes lets you take those stateless application portions of OpenStack like Keystone and then spin up more than a single instance and handles all the proxying for them.
Just burst, give yourself some more processes. It's stateless. Why not?
Yeah, so exactly. So I don't care where it routes to as long as it routes to an active instance and then will give me a valid key so I can log into my service. That's a really valid case.
The point I think that Ethan's reaching out to make here, by the time you've done Kubernetes and then OpenStack, and then started to talk about deploying stuff into VMs and then deploying the apps on top of them. And remember that OpenStack has got storage and compute and networking functions, and you've got Celeometer for telemetry and analytics. You've got, right, you're talking about a lot of complexity there in...
I thought you just called it Celeometer, and I was like, that's an adorable nickname.
I mean, do I just go to a Mirantis and say, please make it better?
You have to carve off something. Like, back to being an individual and trying to figure it out, I have personally focused on the Kubernetes side because I see a lot of opportunity in starting to see the world as artifacts in the data center and a container as an artifact that I pass to something that is smarter than me to orchestrate that. And that, to me, is Kubernetes. If you are to the point where, no, that's jumping a little bit too far into the future and you're partly through the OpenStack world, be part of a community that is making OpenStack easier to deploy. There are fantastic Ansible configurations which will automate a good chunk of distributing a production-ready OpenStack environment out into a cloud service or into an on-premises environment. You're going to want to figure out something other than doing it each piece by piece yourself. So trust in some portion of automation and get comfortable with that.
The point is that software-defined infrastructure as it stands today is not easy.
You're not used to it yet. Well, let's start there.
What I was going to say is, remember that running an infrastructure in 2005, because I remember running an infrastructure in 2005, was uber hard. Like, I had to go and hug the servers. I had to put floppy drives into them to boot.
Sure.
You know, and CD-ROMs to install apps and operating systems. And, you know, those problems are just, we're just iterating now. We've solved that set of problems. It comes back to what I talked about before. The hardware is iterated. It's now easier to use than it's ever been, whether you're bladed, unbladed, whether you're using, you know, software-defined hardware, you know, these modern servers that have all of these APIs, Redfish specification and all that sort of stuff. And now we've got Stackinetes, which is what Mirantis is talking about, which is the OpenStack using Kubernetes. We've still got some rough edges here. So the software-defined infrastructure is a pathway to enlightenment. It's not enlightenment.
Yeah. I think ultimately we have to get to that easy button. Yes, I think there is still a lot of magic to be done, but we are getting there.
Yes.
So I've actually seen... you know, taking a network perspective, at least from an NFV standpoint, the last year or so actually has seen a number of field trials and deployments, both in the enterprise and in the telco infrastructure. And I'm actually very encouraged. I think it's going to take us a little while. But like I said earlier, this is not a turn-on switch. I think Over time, though, I think people are going to actually get to that easy button.
Rajesh, do we have too much in the way of choice when it comes to the networking portion of the software-defined infrastructure stack? I've heard that asserted, that if we could just cut back on the number of different plugins and ways that we can possibly do networking and get the OpenStack community to kind of agree on this, maybe we could move forward a little bit.
Yeah, so actually, that's a good point. And I am a little bit concerned about the fragmentation out there, right? You look at the SDN controller space, even the management orchestration space. Yes, we could actually do with a little bit of consolidation and some standardization. As a company, as somebody who actually started with the torch of this network transition or network transformation, we are actually trying to do, as a company, do our best to basically drive the community towards a little bit of standardization. Even when I look at some of the security services, I talked about service assurance and quality of service, we are actually looking to actually get to some kind of a standard framework that can be adopted by the industry. So you'll hear a little bit more from us in the coming weeks and months.
And Ethan, I can't help but it's eaten me up to think about that. We talked a bunch about should you be learning Kubernetes or OpenStack or whether I need to focus on software-defined networking or software-defined storage or whatever. When we never really addressed the why at all, you have to understand like what are the pieces of the puzzle that you're trying to put together. And I think the piece that really has blown me away is understanding that when you can measure your infrastructure, you can start making decisions about it. When you can make a decision about it, you can start automating it in meaningful ways. And when you can automate it, you can also learn from that process. We have a little OODA loop that we go through when we're presenting people about the SDI story that is watch, decide, act, and learn. And it's for the purpose of abstracting away who cares what you end up using to get there, but you need to understand that these are principles that we all need to be considering as we build out an architecture, or we're going to fall behind.
So we talked about how software-defined infrastructure, what's state-of-the-art, and I think we've talked a lot about convergence in many of the other podcasts, how we're looking at converged platforms, converged hardware, and what we're also seeing is that software is converging. So where once we would have thought that OpenStack was a bunch of different projects, one storage, one compute, one network, it's come together in one thing. We shouldn't be surprised if projects like Kubernetes and OpenStack merge to create Stackernetes and then think, oh my God, there's so much to learn, it's so complicated. Convergence is an industry-wide trend.
The big thing that really stuck with me here was Matt making the point of you got to know what you're trying to achieve here. And so he made the point of measuring that OODA loop, watch, decide, act, and then learn from those actions that you've taken. Where it's not as simple as, we're just going to throw a whole bunch of stuff at this and we're going to automate it all because it's cool and that's what you're supposed to do. Woo! It's you have a reason to do all these things, and there's that loop that you go through to decide what it is that you're going to be doing and why you're doing it so that it makes sense. At the end of the day, you've done something for a specific reason that feeds into the business.
And you've got to be able to realize that state of the art is a moving target. So the thing that you're doing today, what you're watching for, is going to move because in a few weeks or a few months, you're going to say, hang on, this server's not fast enough. This app's not performing optimally. And the story that Matt gave us was pretty excellent. You know, like we finally found out by doing deep, deep telemetry that where the problem was. The state of the art is a moving target. It's not do this and stop.
You mentioned measuring, being able to really have a handle on what your infrastructure is doing. And when we get into software-defined infrastructure, one of the things that you hear about is a lot of telemetry coming off these boxes. And maybe it's a little different from what we're used to if we're doing old-school SNMP queries and WMI and this sort of instrumentation. You know, so from an SDI perspective, I'm going to get telemetry. And well, let's start with this question. How much of my resources should I take up, should I devote to actually getting metrics?
That's a great place to start, and it's a tough question to answer, too. I really like, there was a panel on telemetry earlier this week at IDF. Somebody said, like, okay, well, that very question, how much should I measure? Should it be 10% of my CPU cycle? What portion of my memory profile?
Is that even plausible, 10%?
The answer was, it doesn't really matter, you have to. If you're not measuring, you're not going to be able to know whether you're succeeding. And you won't be able to provide the QoS that we've been talking about this whole episode. You won't be able to provide the quality that will keep you going down a path of software-defined.
But does that many interesting statistics that I would be pulling off in real time and aggregating somewhere and analyzing to have a true understanding of what's going on in my software-defined infrastructure?
Yeah, I am by no means subscribing a percentage that you're going to need to do, but I think we're all starting from a point of gather all the things and then figuring out what is valuable. Now, there's a lot of interesting approaches to make that not take up a huge footprint, and great tools, especially in the open source world right now, like Prometheus is one I've been a fan of, where you collect things at a very tight granularity down to a few milliseconds, but then you roll those up into higher statistics over time, because you only need that level of telemetry for the first iteration of research and seeing into things, and then you roll them up into higher aggregates later on. So the space it's taking up isn't as much, but ultimately it's going to take up some CPU and memory. It has to, but it's going to inform the quality of all of the services of your infrastructure. So we have to see that, like, oh, we don't want to optimize for this small portion of our physical footprint, since we do have the benefit of having a lot of hardware. We should recognize that that's feeding into a fleet of systems that are going to run our entire business, and we need to prioritize
that. Can you give us an example of the kinds of things that we would be measuring that maybe would be something we hadn't thought about before?
Yeah, I found it interesting. I was playing with a HA proxy service that is put into a container that is running on top of Kubernetes, that is running on top of CoreOS, that is running on top of Intel hardware. So that's the slice.
Yay for abstraction.
Yeah.
Yay for disaggregation.
Yeah, and one of the aggregations to the actual front-end application was using Memcached for this case. And we were finding that Memcached was getting absolutely pegged, and you couldn't really figure out why. It seemed that the servers it was running on were fine and everything. You could pull some stuff out of CAdvisor and statistics related to Docker that were actually quite interesting, but they weren't telling you the exact problem. They're just pointing to which part of the server that might be. We got down to a server, and we actually found that LLC occupancy, so the layer 3 cache that's shared across the multiple cores and on the CPU architecture, was actually getting just absolutely evicted constantly. So that's the shared cache. The L2 is dedicated per thread, I believe. But the L3 was getting evicted, which means that ultimately that application was starving for access to that CPU and the memory associated with it. So we found that all the way up to the very top, the user experience was degrading in this application because Memcached was having issues, because it's all the way down to the CPU. And that informed actually the scheduling algorithm that was then put in place. I say algorithm very loosely. Let's call it what it is. Just formulas that we're figuring out on the fly. So we started moving the Memcached service over to a slightly less utilized portion of the cluster. And lo and behold, things were fine.
But you knew why. You didn't just move it and then go, oh, it works better.
We ended up knowing why. You started out with, we don't know what we don't know. But you monitored all this stuff and found the thing.
The thing. And isn't that satisfying to know the thing? And there's something about that we didn't just chalk it up to gremlins at the end of the day. We actually dug all the way down to the hardware so that we understood our infrastructure better. And that's the only way to make better decisions in the future.
And we didn't raise a case on a vendor who then proceeded to put you through 5 hoops. And, like, you know, when you raise a case and it's like, they say, you go to level 1, 3, level 2, level 3.
Have you tried turning it back on and off again?
Yeah, yes. And have you updated the BIOS?
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, come on.
But there are a lot of little pieces to our hardware software stories, and it'd be nice to see it further up the stack at times, but sometimes it is the hardware.
Let me ask this question. We're talking a lot about software resources and hardware resources. What about budget resources? If I'm going to do telemetry, how much of my budget should be spent on measuring and analytics?
You mean actual dollars?
Well, you know, there's a couple of different parts here. It could be capital. I need to go and buy a telemetry. Even though Intel specifically is an able telemetry of the L3 cache to the level of the L3 cache that you talked about, and in right way through the hardware, just being able to poll a counter and see that it's running at this is meaningless unless you've got an analytics platform on the top that can extract that value. Are we talking about percentages of capital spent or percentage?
I wouldn't quite look at it in that fashion, but I will say though that it's important to sort of, like, you know, think about the usage model and the application, and think of telemetry that is very closely tied to that usage model, right? So for example, if I'm building a packet gateway for the evolved packet core next generation wireless infrastructure, and I know that I want to actually instantiate, let's say, a new instance of firewall But the moment I actually instantiate that, it's going to cause a lot of cache thrashes, and it's going to, you know, completely make my memory subsystem suboptimal. So what was actually running really well in terms of, let's say I was implementing a 100 gig packet gateway and it was all running well, and I saw that there were a number of CPU cores available, and so I actually happily onboarded a firewall, except that now everything has fallen apart, right? So I think that would be a good example of, and then I think you go from that usage model and say, okay, what telemetry do I really need to keep track of, right? Because that's actually very relevant to the usage model and the workload.
I know about you, Ethan, but I've basically spent the last 20 years in networking spending nothing on telemetry. Like network monitoring, we've spent a fraction of the total spend on deploying network monitoring platforms, and we use crappy APIs like SNMP. We get excited when we get a chart of interface utilization, right? I mean, there's plenty of networks out there that are barely even installing open source software, and there's a wide range of commercial products, but they're not seeing widespread. That market is vanishingly small.
Got to think about, like, what's your goal a little bit? Because I'm also hearing, like, hey, why don't we turn off logging on all of our servers and all of our operating systems and all of our applications? Because that might speed things up because we won't have to log stuff. Yeah. All right, that sounds great. We'll save a lot of utilization. What happens when things go wrong?
Oh, well, we'll turn it all back on.
Yeah, if you can turn it off and on again, Godspeed. Save yourself the CPU cycles. But if you have to be able to troubleshoot with things in production and keep them running and understand and solve that problem, you need some level of visibility. I will go with the argument that there is an opportunity to have too much, to gather everything. So that's actually something, you know, to nerd out for a second. The architecture of Snap actually gives you the opportunity to fine-tune. You can query everything with a star and do a dynamic query of all statistics. And then when you start seeing correlations, you narrow it down to just like the two or three things that you want and keep that footprint small.
So a couple of tools then. In other words, it's one thing we've been talking about the data. We need to gather data. We should look at the data and do something with it. How do we do that? Now, we talked about Snap, Matt, on DataNauts 33. How's the uptake been on that?
It's been fantastic. So we're seeing some really exciting things. One in particular, so the success of open source is often, will vendors support it in production for a company? And RainTank, the creators of Grafana, are now actually picking Snap up as part of their stack. And they will be using Snap as their default telemetry agent so that you can gather statistics, publish it into Grafana, usually through a medium like Graphite. So you're storing it into some sort of time series system. So Snap is just the ability to collect, process, and publish. You're ultimately publishing somewhere. More often than not, that's a time series database, just given the type of information that's coming. And then you're visualizing it in Grafana because it's the de facto standard for beautiful dashboards for operations engineers and developers alike.
So Snap is open source. If I dig around the GitHub repository, there's an Intel SDI-X GitHub repository that's got all the Snap stuff in it. I noticed some other stuff in there too, like Kubernetes has been forked and is in that repository, and Rocket is in there and it's been forked. What is with the forked apps?
Well, forked, going back to the definitions of GitHub, just to clarify, it just means we have interest in extending it, which makes sense. And if you look at both of those projects, you'll see that there are parts of our team not directly related to Snap that are adding commits into Kubernetes, adding commits into Rocket. I think of it as we're being good digital citizens. We're contributing to projects that we're using and testing.
So not tied to Snap directly necessarily.
No, but okay. You will see another project in there called KubeSnap because Kubernetes needs as many sub-projects as possible. And KubeSnap is, there's a telemetry agent built into Kubernetes called Heapster. And Heapster has some brittle edges to it. It does the trick for the basics, but if you want more advanced analytics and scheduling, and feeding that into the scheduler, there wasn't quite the right tooling for it. So we did a POC called KubeSnap that actually replaces Heapster with Snap in this very meta way. But that led us to learn a lot about what telemetry is valuable inside Kubernetes and be able to offer some upstream opportunities for improvement because we're committers.
Now, I sat on a presentation today, or sat in a presentation today at IDF, the Trusted Analytics Platform. Does that factor into data center telemetry at all?
Yeah, if we go back to that OODA loop I was talking about, the watch, decide, act, and learn, that is a great opportunity for learning, is to feed your telemetry through that cycle and into TAP and what TAP is doing. What's nice is it's an out-of-band process. You can add that onto an infrastructure. I don't think I could dig too much more into that without being way over my head.
I think coming back to my point about percentage of resources, there's two things you need to do here. You need to accept that I'm going to burn 5, 10, 20% of my infrastructure on analytics and telemetry. And I'm also going to burn 5, 10, 20% of my budget on resources or tools to buy those resources. And that is not something, this comes back to my earlier point about we've got plenty of resources, right? And so we need to start thinking about planning in X amount percentage of my budget. Like, if you're not spending 10% of your budget and 10% of your resources on analytics and telemetry and storing logs and 10% of your budget on buying analytics tools or people to operate free tools, it doesn't matter how you spend it, whether it's CapEx or OpEx, I don't care, then you're probably doing it wrong, because you actually then go back to where we were in 1995 going, how does it work? Don't know. Works. Run.
Yeah, and there's no need to run blind these days. That's a very valid point, in my opinion.
Well, guys, we've run to the end of our session today, software-defined infrastructure. From an Intel point of view, we covered a lot of ground. Rajesh, I know you got to run. Are you socially active on Twitter, or do you blog, anything like that you care to share with folks?
I'm actually not very active on Twitter.
I think I found your account. You've tweeted 6 times. Five of them are retweets or something else.
I do plan to be more active. But no, I'm actually I speak at events, and I'm really excited to be here at IDF, because there is so much innovation that is going to happen actually in the software-defined infrastructure space. And it's all about developer at the end of it. And it's great to see actually the developers here at Intel Developer Forum. And I've had really good conversations over the last couple of days. I'm really excited about what the future holds. Thank
you. Great. Thank you very much for joining us. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, I'm extremely easy to find on our Twitter sphere, at MJ Brender, and a podcast as well on the Geek Whispers about technology. Looking forward to you gentlemen joining again. Rajesh, like, also give yourself credit. You support the DPDK community, which is on GitHub. You can also find Snap and other projects from Intel on GitHub. Snap-telemetry.io is a great place to start.
Excellent. And that is it for today's edition of the Datanauts podcast. Thanks to Intel for sponsoring the show today at the Intel Developers Forum and providing some smart folks for us to talk to. And for more Datanauts podcasts about infrastructure engineering, commit every core you've got to a full screen display of your very best web browser and then type packetpushers.net. You can also find the Datanauts on iTunes and anywhere else fine podcasts are shared. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Actually, we better scratch that. I shouldn't go down that path at all.
No,
that's a terrible choice.
I was watching that spiraling.
Yeah, you saw the grave yeah, digging.
I was just about to pull the pin out of the fun grenade and throw it at you.